Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down.
Our guest this week grew up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, earned a BS degree in mechanical engineering and an MS degree in aeronautical engineering from the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. From 1984 to 2010, he served in the U.S. Navy as a pilot. And in 1988, he became an astronaut in Group 17. He commanded three space shuttle missions, including the final mission of the 30-year space shuttle program. Since 2012, he's held various leadership roles with Boeing Corporation. His name? Astronaut Chris Ferguson. And I'm Jack Pasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. I'm Jack Pasula. We're talking to astronaut Chris Ferguson, the commander of the last mission in the history of the space shuttle program. Wow. Astronaut, what an honor. Thanks for coming.
Great to be here. Thank you, Jack.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Oh, absolutely. I grew up in the northeastern portion of the city of Philadelphia, and still have a lot of ties there, a lot of family in and around. My wife is from the area. We met in college down at one of the colleges downtown. But I went to St. Martha's grade school and then Archbishop Ryan High School, parochial schools in the northeastern part of Philadelphia back when parochial schools were really the thing. I think times have changed certainly somewhat. But we lived in a townhome, a row home they called them in Philadelphia, for the first, well, pretty much 16 years of my life. We moved there when I was a young child, and a lot of great memories. You know, that was sort of an age when you still played stickball and hockey in the street and touch football in the street, and the cars that were parked on the side were all in fair territory. But a great neighborhood, and I still keep in just great touch with a lot of my neighbors, some of whom are actually still living there after all these years. Wonderful experience, you know. Very first grade school class that started at St. Martha's. And did all 12 years right there in the Northeast.
What's the biggest thing Mom taught you, and what's the biggest thing Dad taught you?
Wow, I learned an awful lot from both of them. I'll tell you, my mom was great. She was a very young mom. She was just turned 20 when I was born, which is, again, a far comparison to sort of what we, I think, experience today, where parents are waiting longer. So, you know, in a lot of rights, she was a youngster herself. But I always remember there she was there for me. And I would say the one thing that she probably gave me a sense of more than anything else is a sense of responsibility, you know, accountability for your actions. You know, you do well, you'll be rewarded. You do not well, you know, you'll receive some form of reprimand. For my dad, you know, it was costly to send young men and women to parochial school. You know, the public school system, of course, was free of charge. And I think my parents realized the sacrifice, you know, to send someone to, you know, a school that has faith as a background. And they were willing to, you know, outlay whatever it took to keep me into 12 years of parochial school. So my dad taught me, you know, the value of a good education. And he also taught me how to play golf, which I still play to this day, and gave me lessons at a young age. I really appreciate it. Maybe at the time, I don't think I realized how much I would appreciate it, but I look back on those days and really am happy that he got me off in a great sport that you can still play, you know, well into your 50s and 60s.
All right, let's go back 54 years. You're 8 years old, July 20th, 1969, and Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, Michael Collins, Neil Armstrong, first man on the moon. What do you remember about that day?
You know, I remember, surprisingly, I think for being an eight-year-old, I remember my mom hung on to these pictures that I had drawn. I drew a picture of an Apollo spacecraft and the lunar module. I knew the names of all the landing areas for the six missions that did eventually land on the moon. I remember very distinctly that my dad woke me up. I think that the actual first moonwalk was either very late at night or very early in the morning. And I actually remember what he told me. He said, "Son, come on, we got to get up and watch this on television. You'll remember this for the rest of your life." And I knew to a certain degree that, you know, a big event was happening. But I really remember his words, and they resonated with me. And maybe that's what it took for him to wake me up at whatever it was, 4 o'clock in the morning. I can't remember. But I was there, you know, in front of a live TV along with, you know, hundreds of other millions of people around the world in that very first moonwalk. And it stuck with me. And then I became riveted. You know, I followed every mission with aplomb. Like I said, I drew pictures. I knew the names of the landing areas. I knew the names of the astronauts. And I think from that point forward, the bug had sort of set in with me.
Did you ever meet Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and/or Michael Collins?
I have had the fantastic fortune to meet them all at one time or another, not all together. They would bring Neil back. You know, Neil wasn't a real public person. He was a very good speaker. He was very well educated, obviously. But you know, speaking publicly was not his thing. But NASA would always invite Neil back to speak to every new astronaut class, and it was a big day for us. You know, we were all young astronauts, you know, fairly successful in our own right. But, you know, here was the man. I mean, he was the man. And he spent a couple hours with us talking mostly about flying the X-15. And, you know, we thought that was all just amazing because here's the guy who, you know, spent, you know, several hours on the moon. And obviously his time as an X-15 test pilot meant just as much to him as his moonwalk did. But very humble, very very nice gentleman. He spent plenty of time answering questions and shaking hands. And, you know, I think he really, the things that he had to do, you know, after he became famous, I think going back and, you know, acting as a mentor to us little younglings, to coin a Star Wars phrase, was always special to him. Buzz Aldrin was a lot more gregarious and outgoing, and I met him. Actually, I met him at President Obama's first inaugural parade, and we marched together at the end of that parade, and it was a great opportunity to just have a, you know, couple hour conversation with the man who walked on the moon and, you know, left me with a lasting impression. Mike Collins, you know, again, a little quieter, and I didn't get to meet him until, oh gosh, I would say, you know, well into my astronaut career, but humble, you know, great stories to tell, and every one of them, you know, clearly their success didn't go to their head, and they stayed, especially to their contemporary astronauts and those that followed them were always very polite, always willing to share their knowledge with the future space travelers. So all great gentlemen.
We're talking to astronaut Chris Ferguson, and as a teenager, he went to see the movie The Right Stuff, and that inspired him to become a Navy test pilot. 5,700 flight hours later, 30 different types of aircraft. When we come back, we'll ask him about that chapter in his life. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula. We're with astronaut Chris Ferguson. From 86 to 97, he was a Navy test pilot. He flew 5,700 flight hours, 30 different types of aircraft. Tell us about that chapter of your life.
Gladly. I'll tell you, first of all, let me just, in hindsight, looking back at my Navy career, I was so proud to serve my country. Yes, there were hard times. There were times where you were separated from your family for a long period of time, but you quickly forget about the rough times, and all you do remember is the camaraderie and the pride in serving your country. I went to Navy flight school. I started in Pensacola, Florida, where a lot of aviators start, and finished up jet training in Kingsville, Texas, by the King Ranch in southern Texas, a fairly remote part of the state of Texas. And then went to Virginia Beach, where I learned to fly the F-14 Tomcat, completed what we called the RAG, which is the replacement air group, essentially learn all of the skills you need to operate an F-14, to work the weapon system, learn to fly it, and above all, learn to operate in and around an aircraft carrier. I think my first deployment was right around the latter part of 1986, so we were still at the tail end of what was the Cold War. We were embroiled in this cat and mouse game with the former Soviet Union. We deployed to the North Atlantic and spent a lot of time operating in and around the fjords of Norway, which is just some of the most exciting flying because you have an aircraft carrier steaming up and down a fjord, which is like a bay that's carved out by a glacier with large peaks on either side and an aircraft carrier in the middle. And you've got to land on this aircraft carrier while you're in plain sight of mountaintops that are actually sort of higher than your altitude of your airplane. So it's just absolutely amazing flying. And we got to operate with NATO countries, Norway, and we got to do some real world operations because the Soviet Union liked to keep a very close eye on us when we're up there. So we ran a few intercepts and got to enjoy not just working with our NATO allies, but also operating in and around at the time, the adversarial Soviet Union.
Describe for us what it's like landing an F-14 on an aircraft carrier, the USS Forrestal or USS Nimitz, as it's going 28 knots in the middle of the ocean at night. At night.
Yeah, the day and the night is completely different. The day is almost fun. And mostly because you can see everything. You have a horizon, you can see the ship, you have a lot of visual cues to give you sort of reference. You can see other airplanes. At night, everything becomes sort of myopic. It's like looking at the universe through a soda straw. When you're about 10 miles away on what is a long, straight in approach to the aircraft carrier, on a dark night where there's no moon and no horizon, the only thing you see in front of you is a dot of light. And it's this sort of yellowish light. And you recognize the color because it's the only thing that distinguishes, say, the light of an aircraft carrier from a star. But as you get closer, that's the only thing you really have to look at. It's an instrument approach that you do everything inside, looking at your horizon instruments and your landing aids. As you get closer, you can begin to make out the landing area, the lights in the landing area. Now, the landing area is only about 300 feet long, so it's a relatively short runway. Sometimes the added complexity of rough seas can add another element of difficulty because the landing area is pitching up and down. So the viewpoint that you see changes as the landing area and effectively the glide slope changes to you. As you get close, about three quarters of a mile away, the landing signal officer will ask you to call the ball. The ball is a visual landing aid that all pilots use as sort of a final reference to fine-tune their landing to make sure they hit the number three wire. At night, sometimes you'll get a directive call from the landing signal officer. it's very hard to tell when your wings are level at night when you're looking outside. So sometimes you tend to drift left and right of the center line. The LSO will help you. If you go a little high, he'll give you what we call the sugar call, like easy with it. If you go a little low, he'll give you a more emphatic call that would be something like power, all with the expressed intent of making sure that everyone on the ship stays safely and they do the best they can do to help guide you to a three-wire. I've had several night traps. Some of them were very good. Some I would like to have over again because they weren't perfect. But as you may know, all Navy pilots get graded on every single one of their landings. So there is there's a lot of peer pressure to perform, which is very good. I think it encourages everyone to be the best they can be. But I would be lying to you if I told you that after each night landing, my knees weren't shaking a little bit as I pushed my foot on the rudder pedals, which is really where your brakes are at night. And I was almost a little embarrassed to tell anyone that, hey, my knees shake after I land at night on a ship. And I told my flight surgeon one time, he says, oh, yeah, that happens to most people. It's all the adrenaline that's wrapped up in your bloodstream, and that's the one place that it has to sort of make a muscle move, so it causes your knees to shake. I felt a lot better after that. I didn't mind telling people, but I do know that after landing and taxiing out of that dark landing area, you know, it was almost as scary taxiing to a parking spot on the dark at night where you couldn't even see the ocean as it was landing itself. So all things considered, it's probably one of the more challenging and scary things I've done, but I walked away from everyone successfully.
We're talking to astronaut Christopher Ferguson. In 1998, you become an astronaut in Group 17. What did Mom say to you?
I think she had long ago learned to accept my career choices. And, you know, like any mom, they never really want to know the dangerous things that their kids do. So I could tell she was very excited for me, but it was sort of it had some trepidation to it. And I think all moms are that way. Even all of our space launches, as much as she enjoyed, you know, being able to sort of share her experience and me with her friends, you know, which by that time had all been, you know, they were all in their 60s and 70s. I could tell that she was still a little nervous, you know, on every one of my space flights. But they were very proud of me and continued to be so, you know, throughout my astronaut career.
We're talking astronaut Chris Ferguson. Became an astronaut in 98. And 8 years later, after 8 years of preparation, he went up on September 9th, 2006. When we come back, we're going to ask him about that morning. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula. We're with astronaut Chris Ferguson, who was the pilot of Space Shuttle Atlantis STS-115 on September 9th, 2006. You've dreamt about this for decades. Tell us about that morning leading up to the first launch.
Well, we had been delayed a couple times because of a shuttle malfunction. It wasn't a malfunction. It was a problem with one of our fuel cells. Fuel cells were the devices that produced electricity for the shuttle. So we were at the Kennedy Space Center, where the astronauts all spend their last nights on Earth in the crew quarters. And we usually, you know, went out there 3 or 4 days prior to launch. But I think in our case, we were out there for at least a week because, like I said, we got delayed by a problem with an orbiter. And then just when we had resolved the problem with the fuel cell, one of the things called a hurricane, which is not uncommon to Florida, started to become a threat to the Space Coast area there of Central Florida. So they ended up rolling the shuttle back to the assembly building where it could be safe until the hurricane passed. But eventually we got our turn, And, you know, it's a little tough sleeping throughout the night. I think I slept pretty well. You have a great breakfast the next day. You know, they suit you all up. And probably the one thing that I remember the most about the morning of launch is, you know, you take that bus ride in the crew van out to the launch pad. And my commander at the time was a gentleman named Brent Jett, who was just a fantastic aviator. And I thought we would get out of the bus and go straight to the elevator and head up and get ready to get strapped in. But he sort of grabbed me by the shoulder. Got to look at this. So we walked over to what we call the flame trench. And, you know, by this time, the orbiter external tank was filled with, you know, 500,000 gallons of liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. Very cold, minus 300 degrees. And while it did have some insulation around it, you know, the moist Florida air would condense. And off the bottom of the external tank, water was just pouring down, sort of like a waterfall almost. It was amazing. But to just see this majestic space shuttle poised on its tail, and it was like it had almost come alive. You know, it was smoking and breathing and wheezing, and the water's pouring off it. And he looks at me and he says, "Do you believe they're going to let us take this into space?" And it just sort of hit me right there. It was a little bit of levity that, you know, sort of chilled me out a little bit. But the rest of the day went pretty normal. You know, the launch was as pretty much exactly what you could expect. They do a great job preparing us. But that was my prep prior to my first space flight.
And you were up 11 days that time. Then in November of 2008, you went up a second time, STS-126, for 16 days. And finally, July 8th, 2011, a third and final one for 12 days. You're going 17,500 miles an hour, almost 5 miles a second. You see 16 sunrises every day in orbit. So you saw 640 sunrises. Well, what do you think about? What do you remember about those 40-plus days?
One thing that struck me was how much my, I'll call them, increased powers of observation improved with every subsequent spaceflight. You know, the first one is just sensory overload. By the time I flew my last flight, you know, I felt very comfortable, and I was able to really take a lot more in. Like the moment of liftoff, I just, you know, every time it amazed me how quickly we seemed to accelerate purely vertical. It was just very impressive to feel it. I mean, there's nothing that could quite describe it. I do remember on my very first flight, when the main engines cut off, which is about 8.5 minutes after they light, you're in orbit and you go from basically 3 G's to 0 G's. Just like that. I mean, in a span of a half a second. And to someone who never experienced the 0 G's, it can be a somewhat disorienting feeling. And I remember this sense of tumbling, having this tumbling sensation, or I was tumbling forward to the extent that I had to put my hand up on the glare shield, the equivalent of the dashboard, to steady myself. Now, of course, I wasn't tumbling, but it was just so interesting how I just had this sensation the moment that the engines cut off and I was officially in space. But the very first sunrise that you see from space, which we launched in the daytime, but it got dark very quickly. And then by the time I sort of gathered my faculties 20 minutes later and the sun had come up, I just remember looking up out the window because I was very busy. My head was down. I was doing a lot of the normal tasks that you do, you know, to shut a spaceship down. And I looked out the window and I saw the horizon. The sun was just coming up. And I remember my words. I said, "Oh my gosh." You know, you mentally prepare yourself for what it will be like. But to be able to see, you know, the curvature of the Earth, the razor thin thickness of the atmosphere, you know, just the clarity, everything is crisp and clear. And you've got this beautiful green and blue and white Earth, you know, down below you. And now the sun comes up and the sun rises and then it's overhead, you know, in a span of 20 minutes or so. I mean, the sun moves very quickly, and you have an opportunity to experience the shadows, looking straight down at the Earth, and just an appreciation for really how fast you're moving. It's It is a trip I wish I could vicariously take people on, because just doing an orbit of the Earth is an experience of a lifetime, let alone whatever, several hundred that I've did over the course of my spaceflight career.
You mentioned that you love golf. I've never played Augusta, but it would. You had three phenomenal flights, totaling 40 days. It would be like you got to play Augusta three times. And on July 21st, 2011, you were ending your third mission. You were the commander. And President Obama had decided, we're going to stop the program after 30 years. So you knew this was the last time you were going to play Augusta. That July 21st, as you were returning to Earth, what were your thoughts?
Well, first and foremost, I wanted to make sure that we finished on a high note. I mean, every major operation with the space shuttle, you know, launch and landing, of course, are the most visible ones, you know, have a certain amount of risk, and there are things that could go wrong. You know, I think, and I speak not just for myself, but also for our crew of four, you know, we wanted to send the shuttle program out on a good note. And another thing was, we wanted to make sure we recognized those on the ground who had made, you know, who had made it all happen. You know, the astronauts are just the most visible part of human spaceflight. You know, the truth is, it's the tip of a pyramid that has a very wide base, and a lot of folks on the ground work hard day in and day out to make sure it works. So we took time to recognize the people on our flight control teams, you know, the ones that woke up at 1 a.m. to come in and do a midnight shift. So recognizing that those who had really made it happen for us, and trying to be as professional, thorough, and bring the shuttle program to a conclusion that was noteworthy was by far our number one objective.
30-year space shuttle program. Tell us in a minute, what did it achieve?
Well, first and foremost, it I think made spaceflight almost routine. We learned to live and work in space. And that took probably the better part of the first half of the shuttle program. And then the second half of the shuttle program, we really built the International Space Station. I mean, we took, I think the first element went up in 2000. We finished in 2011, you know, this 1 million pounds, you know, 300 by 330 foot, you know, behemoth in space that humans have been working on for the last 23 years. So we left a legacy, the International Space Station, and we left I'll call it the dreams for the future, in that we realized that we can work in space for short periods of time, for extended periods of time. We can fix things when they break. We can fix them inside. We can fix them outside. It made us all realize that we had a future in low Earth orbit and beyond.
We're talking astronaut Chris Ferguson, the commander of the last mission in the history of the space shuttle program. And I'm Jack Pasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WGR.
Jack Pasula, host of WJR's Anything Is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohol. I'm Jack Pasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to astronaut Chris Ferguson, who retired from NASA in December of 2011, and then you joined Boeing Corporation.
Well, we had talked a little bit earlier about the Obama administration and the decision to close down the shuttle program. But, you know, the old adage, right, doors don't close without opening elsewhere. We were embarking on a new effort to commercialize human space travel to low Earth orbit. And there were several companies vying for the ability to provide what ultimately was and is a taxi service. Actually, more of a rental car to low Earth orbit, where NASA astronauts would use a commercial rocket. You know, they'd rent a car to get to their low Earth orbit destination and back home again. And Boeing was one of the companies vying for this. They were very intent on winning a contract to do so, and ultimately did. And I thought it was very intriguing to be a part of that. So I accepted their offer to join them. And it's been just an incredible journey of, you know, how do you take what you've learned over the last 13 years of your career and build a new spaceship? It was just an opportunity that I couldn't pass up.
Talk about that 11 and a half year chapter that you're currently in.
So, like you said, I joined Boeing. I was in Houston, Texas at the time. That's where our program office was. We had to compete, and we subsequently won a contract along with a company called SpaceX that I think most people are familiar with to provide passenger service back and forth to low Earth orbit. So we all embarked on our efforts. You know, I sort of liken it a little bit to the space race back in the 60s, where you had the United States and the Soviet Union with a common goal of getting to the moon, but they don't talk to one another in the process. They sort of develop their own technologies and their own methodologies and their way of doing things, sort of in a vacuum. And that was Boeing and SpaceX. So we built a great ship called Starliner. We flew our first test flight back in 2019. We had a little bit to learn after that, like most new vehicles, most new spaceships do. And then we flew again in 2022, very successful flight, and we're getting ready to fly a crew. But my particular part of it was to help design what they call the crew interface. You know, how does a crew, you know, a pilot work hand in hand with the spaceship to accomplish a mission? And in this era of autonomy, we see autonomous cars, autonomous ships, there are autonomous spaceships. And that delicate balance between providing autonomy to relieve the pilot of a lot of drudgery on orbit, if you will, while at the same time still provide the ability to control the ship was, a delicate balance is a good way to put it. So that was probably my biggest challenge.
We're talking to astronaut Chris Ferguson. If you want to learn more, www.boeing.com. He's the chief astronaut for Boeing. Okay, Chris, it's been 12 years since we've relied on private initiatives for space travel. What has surprised you the most in those 12 years?
Boy, that's a good question. Well, when we started all of this, and it started, I believe, in 2008, when this whole idea of commercial crew took off, there were a lot of graybeards, right? The folks that had been around and in this business since we were working Gemini and Mercury and Apollo back in the 60s, who I think had limited faith in industry's ability to do this on their own. At the time, I was still a NASA employee as an astronaut, and I shared some of that skepticism. I really did. I wondered, you know, could they do it without NASA's help? And I wouldn't say that it was done completely without assistance from NASA. You know, after all, they did have the corporate knowledge. But I was fairly impressed with how we pulled it off. SpaceX, as you know, has been taking astronauts back and forth for the last few years. Boeing is on the cusp of doing just that. And so far, it has been very, very successful. So I would say that that's my biggest surprise, that it all pulled off exactly the way we thought it would, albeit a little bit later. It took us a little bit longer, but you know, human spaceflight, that's nothing that's unusual. So that's probably my biggest surprise, a pleasant surprise.
We recently announced Artemis II, that four astronauts will be going back into space. Will we ever land a man or woman on Mars?
I would say that there is a 100% chance that someday that will happen. You know, Mars to me is always 20 years in the future. I think it's probably that's probably getting to be about the right number at this point. But we're going to go back and you know, we've spent a lot of time on the International Space Station in low Earth orbit, learning to operate away from the Earth. We're going to go a little further now. We're going to go and learn what it's like to be 3 days away, you know, operating in and around the moon's orbit and on the lunar surface again. Once we cut our teeth at what it really takes to sustain humans days away from the nearest Ace Hardware store, we're going to launch out to Mars. So I'm confident, and we're actually taking the first infantile steps right now. The probes that are marching around the Martian surface right now have really set the stage for the future. So I'm convinced we're going. It may be a few years away, but we are going to go.
Chris Ferguson, you grew up in Philadelphia. If there's a young listener tonight who's got a dream to become something special, what do you say to him or her?
Study your calculus and your algebra. You know, it sounds a little funny, but the truth is my technical degree, my engineering degree and my advanced degree, I think really made me the best astronaut that I could be. It really takes a good technical underpinning to understand the technologies that we're working with. So I would say, you know, hang in there, study hard, don't skip a beat, but get a technical degree and learn your math.
And someday you'll not only watch the right stuff, but you'll become the right stuff. Astronaut, thanks a million for joining us.
Thanks, Jack.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.